From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, we'll explore the origins of the slow food movement and where it is today in Wisconsin. Later, actor-turned-novelist Andrew McCarthy writes about a 15-year-old girl who decides to flee the chaos in her life.
I'm a great believer in the value of escape. I mean, I'm a travel writer in my other life. I love the notion of escape, and I often feel like we're escaping to the very thing we need to find as opposed to running away from things. I often don't know what I'm looking for, and then I run smack into it, and I would have gone, oh, that's what it was I was looking for. And that's been my experience in life.
And writer Dave Lurson shares a massive new project, a definitive encyclopedia of classic rock.
This book can represent classic rock, which is a much abused term, by the way. That was one of the first priorities then for me, is to define what is meant by this. So what do I mean by classic rock?
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Mitch Tyke. There's a lot of talk about farm-to-table when it comes to home kitchens and the food we eat in restaurants today. But before we talked about farm-to-table or farm-to-fork, slow food was the watchword. And that concept has not disappeared. In fact, far from it. It's closely linked with other movements which stress the connections between the people who grow, produce, and prepare food. It is an area which interests Jennifer Casey a great deal. Casey is executive director of the Fondy Food Center, a registered dietitian and professional cook, and Wisconsin governor of Slow Food USA. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers and offered a more precise definition of just what slow food is.
Slow Food is an international organization that is dedicated to inspiring people to create a better, more fair, and more delicious food system. It's an international organization that functions in 150 countries around the world. Locally, we have a chapter. We have about four chapters statewide.
Okay. So when we say more delicious, more fair, what do we mean by that?
One of the interesting things about the industrial food system is that while it's done a really good job of delivering high volumes of very cheap food, it's pitted two groups of stakeholders against each other. Those are the farmers on one hand and the farm workers on one hand, and then there are the consumers on the other hand. It's very hard for a farmer to make a livable wage these days. It's very hard for a farm worker to make a livable wage, and that's because we as consumers have come to expect that food is going to be very cheap. So fair food is food that allows farmers and food producers to make a living wage. At the same time, when you increase food prices, that negatively impacts those most vulnerable. It impacts people who have trouble making ends meet. And so what we work to do, those of us working in the good food movement, including within Slow Food and the local farmers market system, we try and create more access points so more people have greater access to good food.
So when I was reading about the slow food movement, to me it seemed like there were a lot of parallels with the farm-to-table movement. How do those two line up?
Well, there's been a lot of interconnectivity over the years. I can start by saying when I first moved to Milwaukee, it was over a decade ago, and Slow Food Wisconsin Southeast, our local chapter of Slow Food, was one of the only groups in Milwaukee that was working on food systems work, working on connecting people to farmers and to food producers. And a lot of what that chapter was doing at that time was farm-to-table stuff, working with different chefs, doing farm tours. And as, you know, the years have progressed, we've seen a remarkable uptick in the variety and number of organizations and efforts that are addressing a better food system. And that could be through food justice efforts, through community gardens, through supporting farmers markets and farmers, and finding ways for beginning and low-resource farmers to get access to the resources that they need to be successful.
So why is it important to hook up, you know, a consumer with a farmer? What's the difference getting your produce from a farmer than getting your produce from the grocery store or wherever mm-hmm. else you might buy produce?
Mm-hmm. Well, when you buy direct, more of that dollar goes to the farmer. And more of that dollar stays in the local economy. The other thing is that you're shortening the food system chain. Right now, you know, most of your food travels at least 1,500 miles to get to you. When you go to a farmer's market, a producer-only farmer's market, where the farmers have been growing their produce or raising their animals, and then they're coming from the surrounding area, you're shortening those food miles and reducing your carbon footprint. So not only are you improving our local economy, you are reducing your carbon footprint and helping ensure that more of your neighbors are making a fair wage.
Well, and kind of on this same line, you have a talk coming up at the Milwaukee Public Museum about food biodiversity. Now, I think a lot of the time when we think of agriculture, we think of it as being this kind of unique system unto itself. Why is biodiversity important in our food systems?
Well, there are many ways I could answer that. I will start by saying we have seen a dramatic decrease in food biodiversity over the last 100 years. This is a problem because diversity is a marker of strength and resilience in any system. It doesn't matter what sort of system you're looking at. And as industrial agriculture has risen, that's led to situations such as the majority of nutrients eaten across the globe come from three crops: corn, wheat, and rice. As those have continued to gain prominence, we've dramatically lost nutrition opportunities. So as you decrease the numbers and diversity of foods that you're eating, you experience less nutrition, which is why, in part, why we have more diet-related chronic diseases. And it also creates a more fragile food system, meaning that we don't have the diversity and the resilience to face climate change or other unexpected futures. So I can give an example. Here in the States, there once existed over 15,000 unique varietals of apples. These days, you go to a grocery store and you might find the Granny Smith, Red Delicious, Fuji, and most of those are coming from Washington State or Australia, from quite far away. There are a handful of orchards that are still raising numerous heirloom varieties, and you can find those interesting heirloom varieties like the Wolf River apple from Wisconsin or the local Milwaukee apple, which is a very endangered apple. Only a few trees exist that are producing fruit. You can find those at the orchards by visiting the orchards, seeking those out, or by going to your farmer's market. They still exist, but they're quite endangered.
So how is Slow Food, the movement and the organization, how is it working to increase biodiversity among growers?
Slow Food is working to increase food biodiversity primarily through its Arc of Taste project. What the Arc of Taste is an international catalog of rare and delicious foods worth saving. So the catalog is a place for people to learn about these foods and to identify foods that are from their area that they might want to grow in their gardens, raise on their farms, cook in their restaurants, share with friends. It's a way for growers, for farmers, for orchardists, for chefs to conserve biodiversity at home and in their work.
How much of this is preserving our history in a lot of ways through food?
Absolutely. It's preserving our cultural and our culinary heritage. So the Food and Agriculture Organization, the UN's FAO, estimates that in the U.S. alone, we've lost 95% of the foods historically consumed. That means they no longer exist. What projects like the Arc of Taste do is to get those foods back into production and onto our plates. It's an effort to eat it, to save it. And it's a very joyful effort. There's a lot of amazing work trying to make the world a better place. There are a lot of issues to work on, but the great thing about working in the food system and working on biodiversity is it allows it to be a joyful work. You come to our farmers market, let's say the Fondi Farmers Market, on a Saturday in August, and you will find one of the most diverse spaces, one of the most diverse spaces in Milwaukee, which is known for being one of the most segregated cities. With that human diversity comes culinary diversity. You'll get recipes from our primarily Hmong refugee farmers. You'll learn about the best way to make collard or turnip greens. And on that Saturday in August, you might find 13 different varieties of eggplants. You know, they can be small, the size of a pea, up to the big, large globe Italian eggplant, and they all have different uses and different histories and different stories.
And I think, especially in Milwaukee, it's hard to see kind of how the slow food movement fits into, you know, what is really a city, what is a very urban environment. How does the slow food movement function in a city setting?
One of the things that slow food does well is to connect the urban with the rural. So a lot of people living in city centers do not grow their own food. They aren't necessarily close to the means of production. Slow food can, through food tours and farm tours, connect city dwellers with the folks responsible for bringing us the amazing food that comes into the city. But also, there is a huge amount of urban ag that goes on. I think later this month, the Victory Garden Initiative's Garden Blitz will be installing hundreds of raised bed gardens. Each of those gardens has an opportunity to grow Arc of Taste plants. So, for instance, that's how I got into the Arc of Taste. I was a home gardener, always in city environments, and I was interested in finding unique and storied plants to grow in my garden that would be delicious. And luckily, there are a lot of places where you can now find Arc of Taste vegetables like the Beaver Dam pepper, which has been grown in Wisconsin for over 100 years, or the Amish paste tomato, which is an incredible tomato for making sauce. Aunt Molly's ground cherry is another example of a plant that's been really popular here in Milwaukee that's on the Arc of Taste. There have been hundreds of Aunt Molly's ground cherries, which they look like little tomatillos, but you eat them fresh and they taste like cherries, a cross between a tomato and a cherry. A husk tomato is another name for it. But that's an example of a plant that people are growing in their backyards or in their raised bed gardens or even in pots on their front porches.
Ultimately, why do you think it's important for people to have a better understanding of where their food comes from and the history of their food?
I think with the loss of food literacy, we've allowed corporations to make choices for us. So as people have become more divorced, have gotten further and further away from where their food comes from, as a society, we've become less healthy. We've become blind to the negative environmental impacts of the industrial food system. The way that we eat shapes not just ourselves and our communities, but the entire world around us. Agriculture is one of the leading forces behind climate change, behind water pollution. So whether or not you are a fancy cook, or you're just a home gardener, or somebody that's interested in feeding their family, seeking out local food producers, farmers, farmers market is something that can improve your own family's nutrition, can help you celebrate with your community members, and have a greater impact on the world around us.
Well, Jennifer, thank you so much for coming in and speaking with us.
Thanks for having me, Joy.
Jennifer Casey is Executive Director of the Fondi Food Center and Wisconsin Governor of Slow Food USA. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers in April. Andrew McCarthy is a name known to many people of a certain generation for his acting in movies of the 1980s and 1990s. Why a new generation is learning his name when Lake Effect continues on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Tyke. For a while in the 1980s and 90s, Andrew McCarthy's face was instantly recognizable for his acting work in movies such as Pretty in Pink and St. Elmo's Fire. You can't mention his name without invoking the term Brat Pack, so there we go. But McCarthy was in other films, too, like The Joy Luck Club. And more recently, he has been a director on such high-profile projects as Orange is the New Black. He's also been an award-winning travel writer, and in fact, he contends that's the work that has changed his life. He is an editor-at-large for National Geographic Traveler. His life has more recently gone down another path as the author of a novel for young adults. Just Fly Away tells the story of 15-year-old Lucy Willows, who has just discovered a family secret and concludes her life will seemingly never be the same. That book brought Andrew McCarthy to Milwaukee this spring, and he visited with us in the Lake Effect studio. Welcome to the show. It is great to meet you.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks.
So I try not to read too many interviews ahead of interviews that I'm doing, but I did run across a handful of pieces for this new book or on this new book. And you seem to be getting a lot of the who are you to channel a 15-year-old girl kind of question a fair bit. So I won't ask you that question exactly, but I do wonder how your protagonist, Lucy Willows, showed up in your mind.
Yeah. Well, Lucy showed up by accident, really. I mean, I was writing another book. I thought I was writing another book for a number of years, like 5, 6, 7 years, really. I was writing a book about a man who had one night fling and a child came out of it. And he kept it a secret from his family. It was really a book about secrecy and marriage and what secrets do to a marriage and over a long haul. And what bigger secret could one keep? So I started with that premise, and I was writing it, and I wrote it, like I said, for years and years, and I could never crack it. And I put it down, and I wrote another book, and I did other things. And anyway, my favorite character in it was always the 15-year-old daughter, who was only 15 years old for about 15 pages in the book, because the book, that giant great American novel, took place over like 25 years. And so anyway, my favorite character, whenever I sort of rewrote for the umpteenth time that section of the book, I loved Lucy. And I found it very easy to write her. So then one day I was sitting on a plane, literally waiting to take off. We were delayed. And I just pulled out my computer and I just started typing. My dad has this other kid living across town. What's going on? And suddenly I was just writing from her perspective and her point of view. And everything about the book then changed.
And what's interesting about how you just put it there is the thing that really is compelling from the get-go is how that knowledge changes everything for Lucy. There's, you know, the finding out of her father's affair and the existence of her half-brother sort of divides everything into what came before and yeah. What will come afterwards.
Yeah, I love that moment in people's lives, the before and then after, and then there are several in each life, I think, and that's one for her. You know, in the book, it's interesting, this book has nothing in common with the other book that I was writing at all, except for this inciting incident. None of the plot is the same. But what was interesting to me was that all the characters were the same, the world was the same. So wherever I went, wherever Lucy sort of led me, I knew exactly the world that she was living in. I knew the relationships and the dynamics with all the people involved. So that was, it was as if the big book died in the woods, and it was a nurse tree, and this little book sucked all the nutrients out of it. I mean, that's the perfect sort of description in my mind. So, because this took everything that was good about that book, even though the plot is not at all the same.
Well, what do you think was what do you think was bad about that book?
Oh, why, I don't know. I don't know that it was particularly bad. It just didn't seem compelling in a certain way, and I think I had difficulty holding the momentum over 20-odd years. And, you know, I think one of the things that I was so close to that other character. I was writing from a close third person, but I was still very much like the father in many ways, that once I had the distance of Lucy, I was actually quite freed up. People don't seem to, people seem to think that's odd, but it's like acting with an accent in a certain way. Suddenly words are coming out that you don't normally say and you're walking funny and but you're free in a certain way. I had a friend of mine who's a novelist, travel writer as well, the wonderful Pico Iyer. He said, a line which I thought was great, that was, I finished my travel book, and he said, what are you working on now? And I said, I'm struggling with a novel. And he said, oh, good, now you can put in all the things that were too personal to put in your memoir, which I think is exactly the truth.
So when you're writing this, are you Lucy?
Totally. I mean, I'm writing from the 15-year-old in myself to the 15-year-old in myself. What was interesting to me was diving into the YA genre, which I knew nothing about young adult literature, which I think is a sort of weird delineation. I'm not quite sure what the point is, but except that it's YA literature seems to have, and today's seems to be very direct emotionally and unapologetic and tackles issues just head on right there in your face, which I really thought was, you know, interesting with Lucy, and she seemed absolutely of that.
Well, I was also wondering, I mean, you have, I think, what, 3 kids of your own?
I do. Feels like 30. Yeah.
Did you feel at any times parental towards Lucy when you were writing her?
I tried not to. I tried not to feel parental toward her because I tried to just follow her and keep up with her. I mean, it was the only time I've ever written anything where I didn't know how sentences were going to end when I started them, which was very exciting. The only thing I did right in the book was that I just had faith in process and just stepped out on each thing that she did. But no, I tried not to parent Lucy because and she's unreliable as an error in many ways. So, but what is interesting is that it didn't have the adult, you know, wisdom, for lack of a better word. She just had the sheer reaction and her emotional, visceral reaction, and that's what the world we were immersed in, which is one of the things that makes it YA. And so, as opposed to, I could have written this from an adult book and had some wisdom about it, I suppose. But no, I tried to completely stay out of the way, and when she was unlikable and did unlikable things, that's people.
Well, right. She's unreliable in so much as any 15-year-old is unreliable, not intentionally.
It's the truth. It's the truth to her. It's like, why isn't anybody else seeing this the way I'm seeing it? What's the matter with everybody? Why does nobody understand me or appreciate me? Why am I so alone in the world? Will everybody else get their act together, please? Which, you know, many of us still feel like, except we have that adult voice in our head, which kind of goes, no, that might not actually be reality, but we can still feel that way. Whereas if you're 15, you're just discovering all this stuff and you just follow that.
And at the same time, most of us don't have the luxury of there being necessarily this one moment where we see a parent differently. It for a lot of us, might be more like the dripping of a leaky faucet.
That's very true, I think. But I think that's when we realize that our parents have their own individual lives and haven't been looking at us all the time and have, in fact, been looking away and doing their own things. I think it's a really terrifying moment. I mean, all of us want to be away from these horrible people that are nagging us all the time, our parents. And yet, when we discover that they are, I think it's a terrifying moment and a moment of betrayal. And that leads to all that teen angst and anger we often, you know, because but I think it's very real because you've been very safe in the world. Your parents have been there watching out for everything, and then you realize that's not the case. Huh. And I think that is infuriating.
And at the same time, thinking about it from the standpoint of a parent, in a way, you know, and I hesitate to say this because my kids maybe are not yet old enough to have completely figured that out about their dad, but it's a little bit of a relief.
Well, I think eventually it's a relief, and I think it's, you know, a discovery of mixed feelings. You know, before adolescence, I don't know how much we're aware of mixed feelings, you know? And I think eventually it's a relief, but it's a process to get there. I think that's largely what the book is about, Lucy's process, and how does one deal with this issue that nobody else seems to need to grapple with.
Coming to terms with the fact that
my dad has this kid that he lied to us about, and don't you think that's kind of important that we should have known about that? and why isn't my mom reacting like she should be? And why is my sister oblivious and not care? It's like, what's going on with everyone?
All of her frames of reference are changing.
Yeah, and it's just her world turns on its axis and, you know, sets her about looking for answers. Which, you know, one of the things I enjoy about Lucy is that she's just impulsive and, you know, she goes on a journey in the book, but it has no intention of going on a journey. She just sort of goes out the door, and then she turns left, and then she turns right, and then suddenly that happens, and she's far from home, and oh, wow. You know, it's one of the things I love about, I'm a great believer in the value of escape. I mean, I'm a travel writer in my other life. I love the notion of escape, and I often feel like we're escaping to the very thing we need to find as opposed to running away from things. I often don't know what I'm looking for, and then I run smack into it, and I would have gone, oh, that's what it was I was looking for. And that's been my experience in life. I mean, travel has been sort of the university of my life. My growth has come from hitting the road alone and then being confronted with issues that were revelatory to me.
This is a perfect transition into perhaps
that's
a little...
That's the business we're in, isn't it? The transition business?
Spectacular segue. there is a section where, and I don't know, this is obviously not a spoiler because you just mentioned it. Lucy goes on a road trip, sort of an inadvertent road trip to Maine to see her grandfather. And it would be great if you could share just a little bit of her getting going on this trip.
She gets on a train. She happens to find herself at a train station as without any intention of boarding one, and then she does. I almost skipped on board. I turned left and went into the forward car. There were plenty of seats, but I walked to the very front of the car and then all the way to the back. The train started to gather speed, and I was looking out the windows left and right, walking back up the aisle, swaying side to side with the motion. I felt giddy. I ended up on the left side in the window seat near the front for no reason. I'd taken the train into the city only a few times in my entire life, once when my dad's car was broken and we were going to the circus, and another time when my mom took my sister and me to see a matinee, and one other time when some friends and I went ice skating at Rockefeller Center. Otherwise, my dad drove us. Not that we went into the city all that much. Trains are very pleasant, except for the fact that very few things actually face the railroad track, so consequently, you're usually looking at the back of people's lives. The people throw a lot of junk out the back of their buildings. My view is scarred by their debris. The redeeming thing about all this, however, is that the scenery moves by so quickly on a train. The instant you see some rusted car, empty derelict swimming pool, things that were originally intended to bring joy, the view changes and you can forget all about the sorry sight and take in the next little disappointment that life out your window has to offer. It was good to be in motion. Lucy.
Well,
I like her.
I do too, and that realization of what you see from a train is something that I think all of us, anybody who's taken a train trip, there's this romantic notion of what it will be like, and then there's the reality.
Yeah, no, I've always thought that was, nobody ever talks about that. That, like, you're always looking at junk and out the back, and it's just not that attractive. Things are not geared toward, you know, it's not front of house.
And there's a reason that the people talk about the other side of the tracks.
I suppose there is. You know, when I was young, I used to go to the railroad tracks in my youth and just sort of alone. And I used to just sort of hang around there and flatten pennies. And it has a place of strange melancholy wistfulness about it and danger, you know, the implicit danger of it and something about it.
The last line there, it felt good to be in motion. Can you talk about the emotion that you get from being in motion? I mean, is it happiness? Is it something else?
I think it's inherently a sense of optimism in a certain way. And I just read this line somewhere. I can't tell you who said it, but there's some, a man with no past is happy. A man with nothing but a past is not. I'm misquoting, of course. But so when you're traveling, you're in motion, it's as if you have no past. You only have future, and you're just right here looking forward only. It's very American that way. Paul Theroux, the great travel writer, said, you know, travel is optimism in motion. And I just think that's true.
What is it about sharing those experiences or those discoveries with people that attracts you to travel writing?
Well, travel changed my life in a very real way. And it was Paul Theroux's books that did it. You know, I read one of the old Patagonian Express, I believe, train book. And he opened my eyes to a way of traveling that I had never conceived of before. And so I started traveling that way, alone and into the world and without plan and without a net, as it were. And I found it revelatory. You know, I just thought it changed the way I perceived myself in the world and the way I looked at the world. So to me, travel had value. It had real purpose. It wasn't, you know, something for the wealthy or the, you know, frivolous or people with idle time. It was a real thing of value to do. And a lot of the travel I was reading about didn't bring that to it. It was selling places. So I just started writing first-person experiential travel stuff that seemed to resonate with people. Because underneath every article that I write, whether I'm writing about Paris or wherever, is that this is important. It changed my life. It can change yours. This matters. And so I think people resonate with that.
Do you think people put too much pressure on having experiences without being necessarily just open to experiencing whatever comes their way?
Well, a lot of travel is not fun. Travel isn't necessarily supposed to be fun, in my mind. I'm not looking for, you know, trophies or various things. I mean, a lot of travel is boring, hard, lonely, all sorts of things. I just become revealed to myself when I travel. It helped me walk through a lot of fear that I possessed in my life. So I think often people expect the wrong thing of travel. It's not supposed to be this greatest hits of our life every moment of the day. That's not what the point. But that's vacation. I'm not much of a vacationer. I don't really believe in vacation. So what do I do on the beach after the first 10 minutes? I don't know. know. So, but I like traveling, which is very different, which is also just putting yourself vulnerable out into the world and asking to be received by the world.
Is it at all odd for you to be doing this version of travel, the version that takes you to bookstores and radio stations and TV studios?
Well, yeah, because people say, oh, this must be great. You must love this. Traveling, I go, this is the anti-travel. This is everything that I don't like about it. It's just hotels to places, to venues, to hotels, to airports and things. So it's not really travel to me. It's just going from place to place, which I actually do enjoy. There's a thrill in arrival that is undeniable, like just arriving here an hour ago in Milwaukee. It's just like, whoa, I don't know this place. And there is a sense of thrill about it.
Do you think about the audience for this new book, what the 13 or 14 or 15-year-olds are going to be left with when they finish reading it?
Well, what I was surprised to find out was the majority of YA readers are actually adults. But hopefully, you know, when I wrote the book, what do I know about being a 15-year-old girl? And I wrote the book in kind of a bubble. Once I started it, I didn't show it to anyone. I normally inflict a lot of my writing on my wife, and I didn't even tell anyone I was making this transition because I already had this book. What was I doing? So I wrote it sort of in secrecy. And then when I finished it, I gave it to my neighbor who was 15, I asked her to read it, and she said, who wrote it? What is it? And I just read it and don't tell your parents. And anyway, she read it and said, this sounds like me and my friends, which was a huge relief, of course. But I suppose what you always want is just people to nod their head and go, yeah, that's me. I understand that. And I have been doing a lot of interviews since I've started talking about the book. I've been shocked to find out that people, at least 24 people have come up to me and told me on a literal level about secret siblings and people that knocked on their door 30 years old and go, I'm your sister. People that showed up at funerals and, you know, stepfather who turned out to be the biological father. I was talking to a reporter the other day and he was very cold to me on the phone and very distant. And I was like, wow, this guy really hated the book. I don't know why he's bothering to talk to me. I can't wait to get off the phone with him. And then right at the end, he goes, yeah, a little, full disclosure. I am the product of a one night fling and never knew my father. And I have two siblings that I've never met that live a few towns over. And I'm like, dude, that's my book. You know, so he had this very strong reaction, which he wasn't allowing himself to go to in a certain way. But then we had a great discussion. But so there's a lot of it, you know, there's a lot of secrets out there, you know.
Do you have a sense for how long after the events of this book Lucy is recounting them?
Oh, interesting. It's not that long. A few months, 6 months. Just like the way when we think we know something when we're young, that was a long time ago. And it was like, you know, 8 weeks ago. You know, I'd say several months, you know, because she's beginning to process. But she's still not there.
Right.
You know?
I was trying to figure out if she knew that she was going to be okay.
I mean, Lucy's going to be a great adult. She just has to get there. That's how I always thought of her. When I did parent her, I always knew she's going to be a great adult, so I don't have to worry about her. As long as I don't get her hit by the train, she's going to be fine. You know what I mean? So I kept that in my mind all the time.
I think it's an underrated part of adolescence, not just the realization that your parents are flawed, but at some point figuring out that you're going to figure it out.
Well, I remember when I was young, staring in the mirror and because I looked so young and literally staring in the mirror going, please let me just know what it's going to be like, look like in 10 years, what I'm going to look for, just for a second, so that I know I'm going to get, it's going to be okay. Because there's a very real feeling that I was always afraid my life just is not going to begin here. And on one hand, your world is everything and you're the most important thing in it. And yet on the other hand, it's like, it's never going to happen. So it's a difficult moment.
And then you wake up and it is 20 years later.
And you're still asking the same things.
Listen, Andrew McCarthy, it really is a terrific book.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thanks.
Andrew McCarthy's recent book for young adults is called Just Fly Away. He's also editor-at-large for National Geographic Traveler and has directed TV shows such as Orange is the New Black and Grace and Frankie. He was also famous for being in movies such as Pretty in Pink and St. Elmo's Fire. We spoke with him last spring. Milwaukee writer and Lake Effect contributor Dave Lurson talks about his latest project, an encyclopedia of classic rock, when Lake Effect continues in a moment on WUWM. We're a of Lake Effect Now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. The classic rock radio format has been around since the 1980s and is still a popular one on radio stations today. But for many rock fans, classic rock is a contested term. It could mean any of the famous artists who changed the rock scene, from the Beatles to Bob Dylan to Joan Baez, David Bowie, the Eagles, Leonard Cohen, or even Led Zeppelin, and countless others who influenced the genre. Dave Lurson often joins us on Lake Effect as a film contributor, but he's also a music writer. His latest endeavor is the Encyclopedia of Classic Rock, written with Michael Larson. The new book defines the age of classic rock as spanning from 1965 to 1975 and gives an in-depth exploration of hundreds of bands and people and their impact that remains more than a half century later. He explains to Audrey Nowakowski how this book came to be and how he wanted to define classic rock, which he says is a much abused term.
In a way, this book was the result of many years of my life from the distant past. You know, the idea was presented to me, and I thought, okay, this book can represent classic rock, which is a much abused term, by the way. That was one of the first priorities then for me, is to define what is meant by this. So what do I mean by classic rock? And by that, I have a theory that I derived from Martin Jack Rosenblum, the late rock and roll professor at the Peck School of the Arts. We did a book on rock music together a few years ago, and he basically had the idea, which coincides with my thoughts about it, that from about 1965 through 75, rock music reached a sort of high plateau, that it became conscious of itself as an art form or a potential art form, no longer just entertainment, but it could actually express something of deeper meaning consciously. And during this time, albums became the primary format for this music. Singles still came out, but the album gave rock bands a bigger canvas on which to paint their ideas. And after 1975, this all kind of started degenerating rather quickly into, you know, corporate manipulation, ridiculous pomposity, and all kinds of other problems. And then punk rock happened and kind of swept all of it away, at least for some people it did. So the focus of the book is 1965 through 75. I wanted the title of the book to be The Encyclopedia of Classic Rock, 1965 through 75, but they clipped that off. If you read the introduction, you will get my thesis point here about the importance of that particular period of time and why the book spends more time, more words on that particular, you know, 10-year stretch than what came afterward.
Yeah, you make some points that I want to touch upon in a little bit greater detail later on. But first off, you know, you mentioned some of the bands, a lot of them British, but artists such as Bob Dylan, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, the Who, these are the quintessential canon of classic rock for innovation and expression, as you put it. So first off, what characteristics did these people and groups have that set it apart to be innovative?
Well, Bob Dylan, I think, is crucial to this and under-recognized for his role in implanting the idea that rock music could be an art form. Bob Dylan associated his songwriting with many aspects of modernist poetry. So, therefore, his lyrics were not simply folk lyrics anymore, you know, old ballads that he kind of rewrote, but had the influence of beat poets, of modernist poets from early 20th century, T.S. Eliot, the whole kind of thing. His work inspired the Beatles and many other bands, particularly in Britain initially, to, oh, wow, okay, this we can do something beyond what we thought we could do. We thought maybe we were just sort of rehashing American music for our audience here in Britain and maybe reselling it to the Americans, but we can actually go further than that. But also there was another thing, too, in the Beatles, you know, we're not the only ones, but this is a very well-known example. What they were doing with the influence of American music was something that Americans would not thought of doing exactly in the same way. They heard American music a little bit differently than people in America at the time did. They recognized things that most Americans were oblivious to. They had the advantage of distance, looking at things from afar and recognizing the continuities between blues and R&B and country music and other kinds of things and began recombining it in fresh ways. Maybe subliminally there were influences from the British Isles that already were entering into what they were doing. And they already, by the time they appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show, had a very fresh take. I Want to Hold Your Hand was a simple song, but it didn't sound like anything that was happening before that time. It in itself was innovative. And was that song art? I mean, again, we can get into the definition of what that means, but it was certainly pushing the boundaries of rock music beyond where it had been until that time.
Yeah, I found it fascinating that British bands had so much of a better understanding of classic American folk and blues and R&B and really understanding that and taking it back to basics and being formulaic about it to make Americans oblivious to the fact that, hey, this is just kind of repurposed American music.
Most white Americans learned about blues from British rock bands in the 1960s, even though many of the people I'm talking about lived about within a 4 or 5 mile radius of African American communities. I mean, this is a way of thinking about the segregation culturally that was still occurring here at that time. The other thing, too, is that there was an awareness of American roots music among the folk music aficionados, the folk music scenes, of which they were widespread across America. Milwaukee in the early 1960s had a folk music scene. But these people, until Bob Dylan began to kind of revolutionize and overturn the expectations of them, they were very narrowly focused on particular kinds of old American music that they found acceptable. They didn't think that what was going on, you know, and a few miles away from them in the African American communities at the time was any good. They liked African American music from 50 or 75 years earlier that they could accept, but not what was going on currently. British bands didn't have these kinds of preconceptions. To them, it was all one big interesting body of work that they could draw from.
Yeah, you mentioned the segregation of audiences and also music because white people didn't know R&B and country blues and things like that, and the black population stuck with their music. But there was so much going on in history, obviously the physical segregation, the civil rights struggles, that I'm surprised a lot of music didn't cross over for those groups who were supportive of each other.
Some of it did. It would be a dangerous oversimplification to say that all white rock music fans of the 60s were somehow like utterly oblivious to contemporary black music. I mean, a lot of people were listening to it, but
there are very few black performers in the mainstream.
Very few black performers who could be defined as rock musicians or rock bands. I mean, there were separate radio stations, basically, you know, for the most part. And even though I think at the beginning of the 60s, there was more of an overlap in audiences, the audiences drew further apart for some reason as the decade went on. And this may in part have had to do with the beginnings of, more corporate tinkering with radio formats and the way that record labels wanted to market things. But also maybe just a divergence in what, you know, people were doing. I mean, I guess if you'd look at the racial or ethnic composition of the audience at Woodstock, largely white, not entirely, but it was largely a white middle class phenomenon.
Also with songs and the culture, a ton of history is happening during this section, and particularly Vietnam. Did songwriting also transition from the more classic one-hit escapism songs to a response to conflict, to a true form of protest, where artists being more conscious of what kind of messages they were delivering?
Well, there was a tradition already coming out of the folk music scene of Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger and people like this using folk songs, particularly old ones, old ballads, revisiting them as a way of pointing out social injustices here in America. So obviously that carried on into rock music via Bob Dylan, but also the whole upheaval of the time, Vietnam and civil rights, couldn't help but influence this newly aware generation of rock musicians who saw themselves, again, not simply as entertaining, you know, their generational peers, but as maybe having something to tell them, something to say to them. So maybe if there had been no Vietnam War, maybe if there had been no struggle for civil rights, and the history of all this would have been a little bit different.
There's also the transition, as you mentioned earlier, of hit songs to full albums, to bands really putting in a lot of thought to a complete set of songs. And it was more about the musical experience, and lyrics had much more emphasis and power. When did this shift noticeably occur?
Well, again, Bob Dylan, you know, when Bob Dylan came to be thought of as a rock performer by about 1965, certainly at the latest, this was very apparent. People began imitating Bob Dylan, you know, almost immediately at that time, sometimes very badly, almost, you know, unintentional caricatures of Bob Dylan lyrics, oftentimes in a much more subtle and original kind of way. Again, he set a kind of standard that people thought, I should even attempt to write meaningful lyrics about something. I mean, it could be, you know, meaningful lyrics about human relationships beyond the level that pop music at the time offered, or it could be about vast social forces at work. It could be about the nature of reality. It could be about politics. It could be about a great many things, you know, a great many topics that probably would not have occurred to the songwriting teams that provided Elvis Presley with his material a decade earlier.
Right. Do any artists or groups stick out in your head that took the more conscious approach to lyrics to their songs that wasn't necessarily a folk genre, but more of the heavy rock?
Well, heavy rock is a whole other interesting thing. It began to develop already by about 1964 or so, and technology had a lot to do with that. Bigger amplifiers, a willingness to explore the distortion that electric guitars can provide, not just as unwanted noise, but as a way of expressing yourself. I mean, again, there were precedents for this fuzz tone guitar. You know, it was first heard, I believe, in the 1950s in rockabilly, and that was by accident. Somebody dropped an amp on the floor, and, oh, I like this way this sounds. In the 1960s, musicians began to, more consciously figure out what to do with all of this, and rock music became heavier, or one strain of it anyway became heavier. Some people have thought, well, maybe there was a drug-related, cause for this, too, that it reflected, you know, barbiturate use or something on the part of some musicians. Maybe it was taking certain things that British musicians particularly heard in the blues and just sort of pushing it a little bit further, like, you know, take a Muddy Waters type of sound and just, you know.
Yeah, can you imagine if any of them had, instead of the string guitar, like plug mm-hmm. that into an app in the blues era and blow you away?
Yeah, I mean, so it's not a huge leap in some cases. So, yes, this was going on. I mean, there's an entry in the book on heavy metal and the changing definition of what that means. I think many people, young people nowadays, have a very different idea of heavy metal and what it meant in 1970. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, certainly by 1970, you had Black Sabbath, you had Led Zeppelin. And again, not everything Led Zeppelin did could be called heavy metal, but a lot of it was. I mean, the kind of heaviosity, the really cement mixer pounding beat and rhythm. And yeah, I mean, this was what would be the precedent. Some blues, maybe Richard Wagner, you know, in terms of some of his music would be a forerunner of heavy metal, maybe. But again, it was a sound that was unfamiliar and refreshing to people at the time.
You also have a chronology section in here, which was really interesting to kind of skim and go through. How was it to revisit those songs and albums as they came out in relation to historical events? Did that change your perspective or spark any memories or influence how you wanted to highlight certain people and albums and groups?
I guess not. There's short answers.
Or did it come last, I suppose?
Well, it came last. I mean, the publisher wanted a timeline of the kind you're describing. And so I sat down, you know, the book was more or less complete by that point, and began looking at this. And, you know, what to me would have been more interesting, and it would have been extremely time-consuming, would have been to do a much more detailed timeline regarding the release of songs and albums. Because so many things were happening so quickly from the mid-60s into at least the early 70s, that it is very hard in a way to know who is influencing who after a point. That would have been extremely, you know, meticulous work. getting the exact dates, like March 3rd, 1965, the Who released this single. And then 1 month later, the Stones did this, and did the Stones single sound like the Who single, kind of. I mean, this would have been more interesting to me in a way to try to disentangle who came first and who was doing what and how all of this was coming together. But that would just have been too complicated, too time-consuming. And so, yeah, I settled on doing, you know, the Tet Offensive was here in January of 68, and then this came out. I mean, in some cases, I think I found some interesting points of connection in putting that timeline together. It probably shed some light on what people may have been thinking at the time.
You also have suggested albums after a little bit of each artist and group. How did you decide that? Was it really the quintessential essence of these artists and people that you found would be a good place to explore for readers?
Some of it was based on historical importance. Some of it is on the personal, on our personal taste. And thinking back and re-listening to a lot of this music, in some cases for the first time in many, many years, really. And I would have to say that in most cases, I found that I either enjoyed the music as much as I did back then, or I come to it as an adult now with greater appreciation of what some of it was trying to do.
Now, as you were going through this book and even revisiting it, talking about it now, do you have some of your top quintessential favorite songs of this era that really exemplify classic rock?
Well, I was afraid you're going to ask that question because there could be hundreds of them, but if I could confine it to three things that come immediately to mind. I really love Painted Black by the Rolling Stones. Simple but vivid, you know, word pictures of what's going on, the state of mind of the depressed narrator of the song. And I've always been drawn to Middle Eastern or Indian music and the sitar and, you know, the minor chords. I mean, it really drew me into that particular song. Bob Dylan's Ballad of a Thin Man. At the age of 13, puzzling over this lyric, I discovered this is a song about a sexual encounter between two men. And it's being played on the radio, unheard of at that time. But that's not all that song is about. That song is like an onion with one layer after another. I mean, it spoke to me in many ways, including the possible complexity of lyrics in a, you know, relatively short, I think the song might be about 4 minutes long, 5 minutes at most, what you could do, you know, on so many levels with lyrics to a rock song. Velvet Underground, Waiting for the Man, I think was very important to me too, and kind of, you know, making me more aware of this sort of scary other world out there, that urban life and all of its gritty, you know, aspects. So those are our three personal favorites, and I think that all three of them, each one of them, says something about an aspect of where the music was going during that time period.
Well, this book is really well done, and I enjoyed looking through it and also just pulling up YouTube and revisiting some of these suggested songs and albums. So well done.
I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Dave Lurson is the arts and entertainment editor of the Shepherd Express, our Lake Effect film contributor, and co-author of the Encyclopedia of Classic Rock. You can find more information at WUWM.com. That's today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and please join us weekday mornings at 10 and weekend afternoons at 3 for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.